Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello and welcome back to the Hindu Studies channel of the New Books Network. I'm your host, Dr. Raj Balkaran. You can find out about my background at rajbalkaran.com/academia. More importantly is my guest today. I have the pleasure of speaking with Jessica Valentine Birkenholz about her recent production, Reciting the Goddess, Narratives of Place and the Making of Hinduism in Nepal. Jessica, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Raj, for having me.
And I guess we should start off by mentioning that Jessica has just recently accepted a position as associate professor at Penn State University. It's a joint appointment in the departments of women's, gender, and sexuality and Asian studies. So exciting times for you, Jessica.
Yes, busy times.
Busy times. So Reciting the Goddess, fascinating book. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about how you got into this project.
Yeah, so the history of this project is kind of a deep one, that the seed, unbeknownst to myself at the time, was planted as an undergraduate during a study abroad program in Nepal. And that was my junior year of undergraduate studies. And that was the first time that I had been to Nepal, and the first time that I heard about the goddess Swastani and this tradition, the Swastani Vrata Katha, that celebrated for a month every year. And I started to do some preliminary research on it then, not having any inkling whatsoever that this was going to grow into really kind of a lifelong curiosity and interest. And so in graduate school, the Swastani Vrata Katha, the textual component of this larger textual ritual goddess tradition revolving around this local Nepali goddess named Swastani, was the focus of my doctoral studies and dissertation, and then became the focus of this first book, Reciting the Goddess. So it dates back quite a while, which I love, and also have always been kind of interested in how things, my thinking on this project has changed over time, and my kind of my own interaction with the goddess and her tradition. But so it's, the origin dates back a long period. Obviously, my thinking about it evolved considerably as a graduate student, and even more so in the final stages of writing the book, and making changes to the book from what the dissertation had been, to kind of bring it up to date and to broaden the conversation out to a wider audience, and to think, you know, more broadly about what this particular goddess and her textual tradition, less so her ritual tradition, because the book is really focused more on the textual side of her practice, but what they mean to Nepalis, both Hindu Nepalis, Nepalis more generally, and Hindus in South Asia, Indian Hindus, and kind of the study of Hinduism at large.
Well, there's certainly a lot of broad themes that we'll touch on, including especially gender and placemaking and this thing called Hinduism that, although we have a podcast dedicated to, we're not entirely sure what that is. And your book provides some interesting insights into the ongoing making of this thing called Hinduism. Maybe the first thing I want to touch on, I do want to touch on Swastani, reciting the goddess, and who is this goddess? Before that, I'd like to ask you two questions. You can answer them in either order. One is, tell us a bit about Nepal and Hinduism in Nepal. Some people may have a question mark about that. But in terms of Hinduism's relationship to Nepal or vice versa. And the other thing is, you already mentioned this is a textual project, so you've spent many an hour knee deep in manuscripts. Maybe you could say a bit about either of those things.
Two really great questions. So I'll start with the first one, I guess. Hinduism in Nepal, question mark, right? What does that mean? What are we talking about when we say Hinduism in Nepal? And in large part, one of the many objectives of this book is to highlight the diversity of what we call Hinduism, which we, you know very well is not a singular term that is homogenous. And so too, in Nepal, we have a really diverse set of practices and communities that constitute Nepal's Hinduism. But Nepal has, for a very long time, positioned itself, the ruling elite have positioned Nepal as this kind of pristine Hindu kingdom. And in large part, one of the things that I wanted to accomplish in this book is to really kind of pick that apart and look at that process of setting up Nepal as Prithvi Narayan Shah, who was the political unifier of Nepal back in, 1769? He called Nepal the Asal Hindustan, the pure land of the Hindus. And this is really how Nepal's Hindu rulers, that they've always had Hindu kings, though the population itself has always been very diverse, both in terms of who might consider themselves to ultimately fall under that category of Hindu, which of course has a much more recent origin in the colonial period, but also a huge Buddhist population, as well as other local ethnic communities who subscribe to any number of different beliefs. The groups that we kind of, the broad categories of Hindus in Nepal fall into two. The Newars, who are the local, the indigenous inhabitants of the Kathmandu Valley. And the Kathmandu Valley was historically what we considered Nepal. And so, you know, there are so many Nepalis today who live outside of the Kathmandu Valley, who when they say, I'm going to Nepal, they mean I'm going to the Kathmandu Valley. So that term still is very much associated with the Kathmandu Valley and kind of its immediate surroundings. And so we have the Newars, who were the indigenous population of that area. And the Newars practice Hinduism, they practice Buddhism, and they practice some combination of both, right? And so there's the common kind of saying that if you ask a Newar, are you Hindu or are you Buddhist, they'll say yes, right? And so on the one hand, we have the Newars. On the other hand, we have the Parvatiya, or the hill Hindus, who are high caste, who came from the hills, mostly the western, but also the eastern hills of Nepal, what we consider today. And were the ones who conquered the valley and then became the dominant social, political, religious group in the Kathmandu Valley and modern Nepal as a whole. And the Parvatiya Hindus, their heritage is from, they claim their heritage from the Rajputs in northern India. So Hinduism in Nepal is broadly constituted by these two main groups of folks who would characterize themselves, broadly speaking, as Hindu based on the practices that they perform and the beliefs that they hold and what have you. But there's a lot of kind of picking that apart is an interesting process and a really important process to understand the ways in which Hinduism in Nepal both has a continuity with the different forms of Hinduism that we see elsewhere in South Asia, on the Indian subcontinent, i.e. India, but it also has its own traditions and its own perspective and its own history. And I'm trying to, in Reciting the Goddess, trying to bring those into conversation with each other, because so often in academia, Hindu studies means the study of Hinduism in India. And I'm trying to remind those who are interested that Hinduism goes beyond the borders of modern India, both historically and today. So trying to kind of tease out some of those differences, the similarities, the tensions between the two, and how Nepal has historically played off of both of those, the tensions and the continuities. And it's in kind of its process of defining its own form of Hinduism and kind of Nepali Hindu identity, right? Which again needs to throw in the caveat that that is not necessarily one homogenous identity, that there's a lot of diversity within that. But nonetheless, sometimes we need to speak in these broad strokes for ease of discussing them, right? So that is what I would say, I guess, to start with in any case, about Hinduism in Nepal.
I was just going to say that it's one of the many reasons that the study is fascinating, because it broadens one's assumptions about Hinduism and where Hinduism may occur. And on a macro level, the Hinduism in Nepal versus the Hinduism in India is really occurring within the Hindu world, within India, across state lines, across caste lines, across sectarian lines. And it's really a great study to see that as you mentioned in your subtitle, really making of Hinduism in Nepal, which really could be an analog for the making of Hinduism in general. And one of, I mean, maybe you could say a word about, you know, what manuscriptology is or what it means, or you know, what is it you do with manuscripts and how you came up with your so how you engage your data. Maybe say a word about that, and also the one key point in that that relates to this first question is the language of the manuscripts, isn't it?
Right. I mean, I was really lucky in this project to have, well, it was both great luck and also a bit of a curse to have just a plethora of manuscripts to work with. So one of the fascinating things about the Swasani tradition is that this goddess is only known via her text, the Swasani Vratakatha. And the text itself is only read during the month of Magh, so mid-February to mid-January every year. They read it from cover to cover. And many Hindus will not open the text at any other time of the year. As soon as the month is over, they do their final puja or worship of the text, and then they wrap it back up again and store it in a safe place, only to be brought out again, you know, the next year. And so kind of there were so many paradoxes within this tradition. The one I'm thinking of at present being kind of the plethora of manuscripts that exist, because most Hindus in Nepal have a copy of this text, and most families will have a handwritten copy of the text that has been passed down through the generations. And yet there's virtually no other documentation of the tradition whatsoever. So it was really just so very fascinating to be able to work with all of these different manuscripts. And I spent so much of my time looking through the archival collections at the National Archives, and there are one or two other smaller archives in Kathmandu that also had collections, but also I spent a lot of time looking at copies that families in Nepal, specifically in the village of Sanku, where I did most of my ethnographic work, looking at copies actually owned and still read by Nepali families today. And so these texts, and to give you a sense of what I mean by plethora, in the National Archives and the other small archives in town, there's about 700 manuscripts available. Not all of them are, you know, in pristine condition, of course. And so in kind of working through which manuscripts I could read, I had to kind of, I developed criteria according to which I would slim down my options of manuscripts to read. And one thing included, you know, that they had to be complete. So they had to have a beginning, go from the beginning to the end. They needed to be undamaged enough to read in their entirety. And they needed to have a date so that I could locate them temporally in Nepal's history. Now, this ruled out the vast majority of manuscripts that are still extant in these archival collections, but it still gave me hundreds with which to work. And you had raised the question about language, which is so important. So this tradition originated among the Newars, and for about the first 200 years of its history, it was passed down almost exclusively in the Newar language, which is a Tibeto-Burman language, so it differs rather significantly from Sanskrit and Nepali, which are Indo-Aryan. But Newar is very much influenced, extremely so, by Sanskrit and today by Nepali as well. So there's a lot of vocabulary interchange, and in fact, the very oldest of the Swastani manuscripts is in Sanskrit. But as I argue in the book, I think that that's more of a fluke than anything, that in part because it is a very Newarized Sanskrit. The Sanskrit is very corrupt. And so it reflects kind of a greater knowledge of Newar than it did Sanskrit, but an attempt at putting the Newar into the Sanskrit. And then, as I said, for the next 200 years, it's almost exclusively in the Newar language. And then around, so the tradition, I should say too, the oldest extant manuscript that we have is from 1573. And it's not until the early 19th century that the text is finally translated into the Nepali language. And then it takes off in an entirely different sort of way with a much larger audience. At this point, the Parvatiya Hindus, the high caste Hindus from the hills, had conquered the valley and were, you know, kind of establishing their hegemonic claim over pretty much everything. And so the translation into Nepali changed the tradition at that point to some degree. But so one of the things that I try and kind of tease out in the book is the dynamic between these three languages, Sanskrit, Newar, and Nepali. And for me, this was absolutely one of the most interesting aspects of the project, and one that I really enjoyed as someone who loves languages and loves working with these manuscripts and thinking about how language is representative of so much more than just words on the page. And while there have been some really excellent studies about each of those languages in the Nepali context, there has not been anything that brings them into conversation with one another. So I wanted to kind of use this textual tradition as a vehicle for having that conversation and for providing a case study, right, that literally was able to show the way that these three languages interacted and were representing different communities and how those communities were interacting and how this then most broadly mapped onto historical, political changes to the landscape. landscape that a lot of, you know, all the kind of textbooks on Nepal, well, there really aren't any textbooks on Nepal, but, you know, the standard historical studies of Nepal map out very clearly. But this provides us with some of the nitty gritty about what was actually happening on the ground and the way popular movements isn't quite the right phrase, but the way that things were happening on the ground and in practice.
So language is such a rich vehicle above and beyond just the conveyance of semantic meaning or ideas. Language so unconsciously conveys culture. It's so internalized. We don't even realize the extent to which our culture is carried by and conditioned by the very words we use. And it's very fascinating in this circumstance, of course. Just to be clear, if one were to go and listen to, we'll call the SVW, the Sustani Vatakata, for those of you who are interested, the SVW is the primary text that's being studied. What's that?
I use the acronym SVK.
Sorry, SVK. I definitely need some more sleep today. SVK. But when it's currently recited, what language do people hear it in? Is it a language that they speak? And you mentioned that the Sanskrit manuscripts are probably anomalous. Maybe say a little bit about the Sanskrit cosmopolis and why, and the motivation that a medieval tradition would have to Sanskritize the text.
Sure. So I'll say something about that first and then move to the modern period. So the motivation for kind of Sanskritizing the tradition is very strong, right? You mentioned the Sanskrit cosmopolis, this notion of Sanskrit as this cosmopolitan language that traveled far and wide. It was accessible to huge swaths of South and Southeast Asians, but it was the language of the elite. And it was the language of the gods, right? As Shelley Pollock and others have discussed. And so that serves a certain purpose, right? And sets a certain standard quality is not the right word. The word I want is escaping me at the moment, but this notion of kind of the caliber of the writing, it's a means of legitimating the existence of the work. And really of kind of placing the text within this larger body of Sanskrit literature, right, that was circulating on the Indian subcontinent and in many cases beyond. And so there was definitely, I would argue, that drive there for some of those who were, you know, these religious actors who were involved in propelling the tradition, perpetuating it, transmitting it. To make those claims. And the claim is made really from the very beginning of the tradition, insofar as in the colophons of every Swissani manuscript, regardless if it's in Sanskrit, Newar, or Nepali, every final colophon has indicated that the text comes from a Mahaprana. Usually these days, and for many centuries, it's been the Skanda Prana that's been favored. Originally, it was the Linga Prana. The Swissani Vrata Pujavidis, the ritual instructions, usually say that they hail from the Padma Prana. But so they're establishing these claims of heritage to the Maha Sanskrit Prana tradition that provides a certain amount of legitimation and authority to this very local tradition. But again, throughout its history, with all of these just so many manuscripts in existence, and really the 700 or so that have been preserved at the archives, they stopped preserving them. It was an initiative by the Nepal German Manuscript Preservation Project. from roughly the 1970 to 1990 to preserve Nepali manuscripts by microfilming them. And they finally stopped collecting Swistani manuscripts because they had so many. So the fact that there's only 700, while that seems like a great number compared to, for example, in Nepal, one of the other very important local texts is the Swayambhu Purana that talks about the origin of Swayambhu Nath, this great local Buddhist stupa. There's only 100 manuscripts available. So the fact that there are so many more in Swistani, obviously there's lots of circumstances that could lead to the survival or destruction of any of these. But there were so many in existence. And again, most of those would have been either in Newar or in Nepali later on. And in terms of kind of the second part of your question, or I guess it was the first originally, in terms of contemporary recitation of this tradition, largely the direction is shifting towards Nepali language texts. And this is largely because the older handwritten texts that are written in Newar were written in classical Newar. And in the older Nepal script, which is to say not Devanagari, which is the most dominant and widely used script in Nepal today, so fewer and fewer Nepalis, Newars in particular, can read this older language and the older script that the text is written in. And that forces them to turn to a modern version of the text. And the version, the modern version of the text that is ubiquitous throughout Nepal is a printed Nepali language version. And this is for a number of reasons having to do with control over the printing presses when they first emerged. But Newar language, Swistani texts have never taken off at the printing press. There are a handful that have been put out in small numbers by individual, you know, individuals publishing it themselves and distributing them themselves. But by and large, the text that is widely available that you can see in stacks of them, and they're bound in red covers, and they're literally stacks of them throughout Kathmandu during the festival season, those are all written in Nepali. So it's an interesting thing to go to Nepali households these days to see kind of what they're reading. And many times they'll bring out their older handwritten SVK text and they'll worship it, but then they'll worship and ultimately read a modern printed Nepali language text.
So that's fascinating for so many reasons. I quite enjoy obviously all of the books we review here, but this one, it's there's so many parallels to the work that I do in that. For example, I study narrative text about a goddess figure that has a ritual tradition attached, and yet there's so many differences in that the text is only recited in Sanskrit. The efficacy of the telling of the story of the goddess has to be in this, in the language of the gods, so to speak. So I find that very fascinating. So we have this intriguing syncretic religious space called Nepal. We have these stacks of manuscripts that you combine and make sense of. And they all, the manuscripts obviously being those of the SVK, and they pertain to a specific goddess, Swistani. So tell us about the goddess.
Well, the goddess Swistani, she's interesting. And I have to admit that my interest in her came rather late in this project. My motivation for the project was a textual historical study of the Swistani Vratakatha, about which no other work has really been done, looking at its history and development. And I was really interested in kind of those different steps and movements, shifts, different articulations, accretions, and what have you. And so the goddess, my interest in her developed a little bit later in the process of writing this book. She's a notable goddess for the fact that she's very non-specific, let's say. So her name, Swasthani, swa, right, means one's own, stan, place, and the I at the end feminizes it, right? So she's the goddess of one's own place. But that is delightfully unspecific, very ambiguous about exactly what that means, right? As opposed to so many other goddesses whose name reflects a very clear attribute of their person, their powers, their place, right? Gauri, the pale one, Parvati, the goddess of the mountains. So the fact that she is ambiguous, I argue is intentional, right? That allows a lot of flexibility to this local goddess. And ultimately, kind of my reading of her is one that shows how the nature of place, right, is very specific, and it's very referential, and it changes. It's not tied necessarily to a specific time and place, but notions of place evolve and change based on a lot of different factors. And so kind of what I see throughout this whole project is the ways in which her as a goddess of one's own place it reflects one's own place at the most kind of minute level of an individual and their place in life, in their family, in their village, their community. But it starts to balloon outwards, right? And there's that possibility of that place being Nepal. So in the book, there's a wonderful illustration of the front cover of a modern printed Nepali, that one might be Nehwar, actually, one of the few Nehwar ones, where on the cover, it has a map of Nepal and the word Swasthani written across it in Devanagari, right? Which is a clear visualization and articulation of that's relating the goddess to kind of the nation in a way, the most explicit way I've ever seen in my work on her. But she offers that flexibility to be relevant at all of these different levels and at different time periods to note that those notions of place are in flux, right? And I tie this back to kind of the making of Nepal and the making of Hinduism, because Nepal, as we know it today, has obviously changed considerably from what it was in the medieval period or before that, right? And so kind of the way that she comes to represent Nepal and could be seen, you know, as from the Nepali perspective, as our own goddess, right? As our goddess of this place, kind of distinguishing her from and themselves from that other place, namely India, right? And so she's in the story itself, it's a Vrat Katha, so it's a devotional votive rite and a story about the goddess, but it doesn't actually tell us that much about her origins per se. It tells us just how to perform the Vrat. And she's called Swasthani Parameshwari. So she's this supreme being too that Parameshwari indicates, but is both a benign, benevolent goddess who's often associated as Shiva's consort, but she also has, you know, a bit of an anger issue and causes a bit of destruction in the story as well. And so she also reminds us in that moment of afflicting and healing goddesses, right, who are both the disease and the cure. So she's a complicated figure, but also curiously generic in certain ways that I argue enables the local community to utilize her as needed.
Well, the
different times and contexts.
Yeah, I mean, there's so much that's fascinating about this project. Can you hear me okay?
What's that?
Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Oh, perfect. There's so much that's fascinating. What comes to mind is the distinctions of the literary theorist Umberto Eco, the world behind the text, the world within the text, the world in front of the text. And they're so very much fascinating with the world behind the text, and it's understandable why it's compelling to tease out the history of this text and its various iterations and its linguistic and cultural and political implications. Now more to the heart of the kinds of questions that I asked in terms of the world within the text, the literary devices, the characterizations. I think you're really onto something. It's a fascinating medley of throughout Hinduism, the various goddesses, and invariably they will be conceived of as an aspect of one Parameshwari or Mahadevi or a great feminine divine. But they'll invariably have very, very specific characterizations, biographies, quirks, abilities, relationships with characters. And there is something about this goddess that despite the things that are distinctive of her, there is something paradoxically generic. And the pun that came to mind in my brain as I was reading this is she's very much a placeholder, isn't she? She's a placeholder for placemaking itself, it seems. And that ambiguity it doesn't strike me as a lack of creative ingenuity at play. It strikes me as a very conscious margin and a space so that you can read into her and establish her in the space, in whatever epoch that is, or whatever even geographical space. So I find that really, really fascinating. I definitely perceive that strange paradox of a particular goddess who's also generic, almost like the perfect diasporic goddess.
Yeah, well, and I think I'm glad that comes through, because I think that is very much the case. And I really, I see it as very intentional insofar as this goddess seems to have emerged in the late 16th century, and her tradition gradually grows and becomes much, more and more popular and prevalent throughout Nepal. And the time of her origin was a time when new goddesses were kind of emerging on the landscape in Nepal and elsewhere in South Asia. So she's part of a broader trend, but again, stands out for that kind of lack of specificity that allowed her to maneuver, as you say, into different spaces in ways that might not have been afforded to other goddesses whose identities and roles are much more specifically delineated.
You know, as you speak about her, you use a trope in speaking about her as you do in writing about her. One that I have not... I have generally not been cognizant of or used personally, but it's fascinating. You write about the goddess rather than say the ways in which she's appropriated, you would phrase it the ways in which she moves from space to space. And it's really an engaging way of thinking about the deity as having agency, of sitting there for a month and receiving this and doing this. It's really fascinating to me. I don't know if this makes sense what I'm pointing to, but it's the idea, like you present the goddess as having sentience and agency in a way that I think is very compelling in how you write about her.
Well, thank you. I think there's lots of arguments to be made and about kind of the role of different religious actors who are involved in different religious practices and how they evolve and develop. But I do think that it's important that, at least from a devotional point of view, that Nepali Hindus see her as being agentive, right? And they, in fact, worship the text as the goddess. She does not have a history of graven images. She does not have a history of being depicted in statue form or wood carvings or paintings. That develops to a limited degree kind of later in her tradition, but it's her as the text. And so kind of the agentive role of her as an actor, as well as scribes and patrons and devotees, are all kind of part of the same mix. And I don't want to overstate kind of her role, because of course, how can we judge that or assess that, quantify it? But I think it's important to acknowledge that from the perspective of those who are involved in the tradition, she is very much part of how her tradition has moved forward throughout the centuries.
I find it quite useful. One may, if from an academic perspective, if you're doing scholarship on a religious tradition, one may think of it as perhaps obscuring what's happening in terms of speaking of the object of worship as an agent. But in this case, very much so. It sheds light, right? Like thinking and speaking and writing about the goddess as agentive affords a level of insight into the lived religious practice that would not be there otherwise. That's my sense. Speaking of the lived religious practice, certainly there's much to be said about this book and gender or women's lives or women's roles. Maybe I should leave it more open for you to comment on that. But one anecdote I found really fascinating, I think it was maybe in your second chapter when you were talking about the goddess herself, was that, if I'm not mistaken, you had three trips where you were there and heard the kata being recited. The first one it was recited, the second one it actually wasn't, but the third one it was recited by a woman who stepped up to do that. And so maybe you can comment on that anecdote, or maybe more broadly the gendered roles or the ways in which this tradition really is anomalous to a lot of gendered religiosity in South Asia.
Right. Yeah. So great question. And the kind of vignette that you're referring to historically. So as I've already indicated, the text is recited over the course of a month. The modern printed Nepali language SVKs are conveniently divided into 31 chapters. So that's pretty cut and dry. The older handwritten Newar language ones are really varied in their length and chapters, maybe there, maybe not. But historically, you know, families would read for themselves and for their neighbors, and obviously I'm meaning family writ large, so these are large joint families reading together. So not necessarily every household may not have a copy of the Susani, but certainly a neighbor would, right? And you would, all signs indicates based on current practice that you would go and listen to it somewhere nearby. Now, the ritual component of the tradition is such that the vrat, the ritual vow, can be observed either privately in your own home, or you can go and participate in a public communal performance of the vow in a village called Sanku, which is about 17 or 18 kilometers to the northeast of Kathmandu. And for many, many years, there's been this public communal performance of the Susani Vrat there. And historically there, the priest of the ritual arena would read out loud a chapter a day. And in modern times, he would do this over a microphone. So one of the first times I guess it was the first time that I had observed the recitation in Sanghu was in 1999. And indeed, the priest read out a chapter a day over a microphone, which was very hard to understand because the quality of the equipment wasn't very good. And then some point later, maybe it was in the mid-2000s, I had gone back and, you know, I've spent a lot of time in Sanghu over the years, and would obviously try and go during the festival month. And I think it was around 2005, 2006, when they were not reciting the text, because the former priest had died and they hadn't found a new priest, or the new priest that they had found didn't know Newar. He was a Parvatiya Hindu. So he knew Nepali and Sanskrit, but he did not know Newar. And the copy of the SVK that was read every year in the ritual arena was in the Newar language. So he did not read it. So, you know, I took note of that. And then when I was back again, I think somewhere around 2014, a woman was reading it out loud. And I befriended this woman. Her name's Amita Sresta. And she was a lawyer. And due to both her conviction as a devotee of the goddess and someone who had performed the fast in Sanghu years before, and as a lawyer who was familiar with reading lots of different handwritings, different scripts, handwritten scripts, she took it upon herself to read the old text. And she did, and it was really quite something, because historically it would, of course, be the senior male of the family who would read the text out loud. And the text itself is very gendered. It is, in the eyes of many Nepalis, it is not, in fact, very women-friendly. It deals with a lot of domestic issues. That includes child marriage, the move from one's natal home to one's husband's home and the challenges in that, motherhood, widowhood, all of these sorts of things, but in ways that are towing a very kind of conservative, orthodox, Brahmanical line as far as women are concerned. So it's been an interesting kind of process for me over the years to understand what it means for this to be a women's tradition. Because for so long, particularly in the early years of my research, one of the first things that Nepalis would say to me when they would find out that I was studying this Wasani tradition is, oh, that's a woman's tradition. And sometimes they would say this, you know, very pejoratively. Sometimes they would say this with pride. Sometimes they would just state it as fact. But over the years, I've begun to hear many more different kinds of conversations about the tradition that deviate from kind of what was the resounding refrain about the tradition as a women's tradition, as empowering for women, and seeing the suffering that they go through and the story and that they overcome this suffering, right? And most recently, and I wrote an article about this that came out in Science, a journal for women and culture and society last winter, that looks at contemporary feminist interpretations of the text, which really take the text to task for promoting gender discrimination and lots of different ideas and tropes about women and practices related to girls that are harmful to them. And given the popularity of the tradition in Nepali culture, Nepali Hindu culture, that how harmful this is in society today. So there are lots of voices and perspectives on this that really range from the very devout, and this helps women understand how to deal with daily challenges in life and to overcome and to be a good devotee, to those who outright reject it, as something that is not very productive for women today. But in the book, I don't get into the most contemporary period. The book stops around the early 20th century, or excuse me, the early 21st century, because that's when the text kind of crystallizes into its contemporary form, and it hasn't changed much since then, whereas there were huge changes from the earliest text up to that point. So in kind of the context of the book, it's focusing more on the ways in which kind of the women's question of 19th century India bubbles up into Nepal. And you know, I argue that a lot of the changes that we see in the text, and by changes I mean the different stories that are added in. So the original SVK was just this local Newar folktale about a mother, a son, the daughter-in-law, and the goddess. But over, you know, two centuries, from the 18th to 20th century, it adds in a lot of Puranic, Mahapuranic stories about Shiva, primarily some about Vishnu, but mostly Shiva, that bring in more kind of Brahmanical discourses, and that includes Brahmanical gender discourses that position the text into a certain discourse on women and their expected roles and practices. That is then what's promoted throughout Nepal.
So there's clearly a very fascinating history and dimension. Just quickly, before I ask the next main question, you mentioned that this study doesn't so much look at contemporary practices, basically since the text crystallized. Is that something you intend to work on at some point?
That's a good question. So the text, both the meat of the text of my book, that is, does end in terms of looking at the historical development of the text, it does end around the early 21st century. But because this is a living tradition still holding a place of primacy for Nepali Hindus today, I do incorporate ethnographic research that I've done over the years throughout the whole book that help illustrate kind of the ways in which different ideas and practices that we see historically are playing out in the contemporary period. So there's both ethnographic accounts from my own research and time in Nepal and in Sanku in particular, conversations that I've had with different Nepalis about the text and the story and their family practices, but also draws a lot on contemporary media accounts, so different newspaper editorials, blog posts that bring up the Susani and lots of different fashions. So while kind of the textual historical arc of the project is really from the late 16th century to the early 21st century, it still, I hope, gives enough of a sense of what's happening around the text in the most contemporary period today. And I find, though, that these practices are continuing to evolve to some degree, or the conversation is evolving. The practices have not changed much. So the article that I wrote for the journal Signs in many ways kind of served as an epilogue for the book because it looked at the most contemporary present moment and reactions to the text and the ritual practice in Nepal today. But this is, you know, this project for me has such deep roots that I will probably to some degree, you know, follow the tradition moving forward. I'm very interested in seeing how kind of in today's discourses on, you know, the Me Too movement and secularism, which is new to Nepal, how these are changing conversations in general in Nepal and Nepali Hindu society among Hindus, And so I am interested. It's not the main focus of my current project, but it's something that I will always kind of have my ear to the wall, as it were, and even more than that, I mean, I will always have eyes on this tradition to see how it continues to move forward, because it's those changes in the tradition that have always really interested me, and how something that kind of came from obscurity became so central in Nepali culture, kind of the heart of their Hindu society. And so what does that mean moving forward? And now that Nepal is officially, in any case, secular, and as we enter into, you know, the increasingly globalized world that we live in. So I think there's going to be some interesting things to observe moving forward in the years to come.
All sounds quite fascinating. So perhaps that's a good lead in to a question that I often end with in these interviews, which is, why don't you tell us, what are you working on now?
So my current project really takes up my interest in gender and religion. And this is something that undergirded my project on the Sasani tradition, which led me to it in many ways in the first place, of being interested in women's practices. And for me, kind of the Sasani tradition as a textual practice, a woman's tradition, quote unquote, and in Nepal, which is a place that I feel very passionately about, as well as very at home while there, that the Sasani project brought that all together very nicely. And kind of as that project came to the, you know, a close, again, with never a permanent ending, I don't think. But my interest in kind of the contemporary period and contemporary conversations about women and gender, and to see how notions of women and gender are changing in Nepal today. So, and specifically, again, in Nepal as a place with such a deeply historical Hindu worldview, and deeply entrenched Hindu practices as the hegemonic norm against which all else is devised and judged and built. So my current project is a look at sexual and gender minorities in Nepal, specifically kind of stemming from a conversation about the third gender in South Asia, which has very different implications in the Nepali context than it does in the Indian context, but looking at the third gender and other sexual and gender minorities in the Nepali context to do an intersectional study of these communities with, in terms of religion, ethnicity, and sexuality, and to bring this into conversation with broader discussions about these communities globally, but also kind of broaden the conversation that has happened in the South Asian context for so long on hijras in India, to move beyond both hijras and India to see what's happening elsewhere.
So sounds like equally fascinating work. We'll have to have you back on the program when you publish that book. So thank you very much for your time today. For those of you listening, we've been talking with Dr. Jessica Valentine Birkenholtz, who is currently associate professor in the Departments of Women's Gender and Sexuality and Asian Studies at Penn State University. And we've, of course, been talking to her about her exciting new book, Resetting the Goddess, Narratives of Place and the Making of Hinduism in Nepal. Until next time, keep reading. Take care. Thank you.